A lot of people say, well, what motivates you to do this? It's because I love the church. It's because I care about the reputation of God.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where we speak to Christians in the public eye about their life, faith and ministry. It's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian publication. If you'd like to receive a free sample copy, go to premierchristianity.com/free sample.
You're listening to The Profile.
Today on the show, I'm speaking with Julie Royce. Julie is a journalist based in Chicago who specialises in investigating corruption and abuse within the church. Previous projects include research into the sexual misconduct of apologist Ravi Zacharias, abuse and financial mismanagement at Willow Creek Community Church, and bullying within the Acts 29 church planting network. Before setting up the Royce Report, Julie worked as a national talk show host and a reporter. She's written news and comment for media organisations, including Fox News and several Christian publications. Julie, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, Megan. Looking forward to chatting.
It's a real pleasure. Julie, on your website, it says that you expose corruption in what has been termed the evangelical industrial complex. What does that phrase mean to you?
Well, it's become an industry. And I think that's part of the problem of why we're seeing so many scandals is because you have, you know, publishing, you have broadcast, you have the mega churches, you have the conferences, you have these huge celebrities who are making a lot of money for a lot of organizations. And so you have this interconnected web of Christian ministries, and it doesn't have to be bad, right? I mean, there could be an interconnection that would hold each other accountable, call each other out, be the church to each other. But unfortunately, what I've seen happen, and actually that term, evangelical industrial complex, it was actually coined by Sky Jathani, who was a reporter for CT, now an author. He lives in my area, and happened to meet with him just yesterday. We had coffee together. And he asked me, you know, why do you think we're seeing all of these things? Is there something really new? And I said, well, it's become, and again, it's an industry, right? And so whenever you have money involved, whenever you have power involved, unfortunately, we're seeing that there's protection, there's sin, there's not calling each other to account. It's instead, I've got your back, right? I've got your back. In fact, Dave Ramsey, who has a huge financial, I don't know what you call it. It's not a ministry, but it's a whole financial planning business, you know, that markets towards Christians. There's an entire staff meeting where he talks about, I've got your back, I've got your back. And he talks about some of these celebrities that have been in scandals, you know. And this idea of I've got your back, I don't see it biblically. I see that the wounds of a friend are faithful. Mm-hmm. And that we should be calling each other to account. 1 Timothy 5:20, we've forgotten about that an elder who is sinning should be publicly exposed so mm-hmm. that others may stand in fear. And so that's what the evangelical industrial complex is to me. And I think it's unfortunately why I'm reporting right now, why I have a job. I'm like, I would love to be put out of a job. I would love there to be no scandals, no corruption. No abuse in the church, but unfortunately, that's the point that we're at, and I'm just trying to be faithful in this space.
Julie, do you think that there is something about the megachurch model in particular that fosters these kinds of problems? Because I mean, we're here in the UK, we don't have this same obsession with megachurches. I mean, we have a few that are starting to grow and that are bigger. You know, we have Hillsong here and a few like that, but we don't really have that same culture of mega churches. So is this a particular problem that you see in these types of very large churches? And is it to do with lack of accountability? What's the issue going on there?
Yeah, I think the mega church, you've created an entire system with a huge amount of money that is completely unregulated and completely non-transparent in most cases. So in the United States, if you have a nonprofit, say you're a secular nonprofit organization, you have to file what's known as an IRS 990. So it's a tax form. And you would have to declare the salaries of your top three executives, for example. You would have to show how your money is being spent, because there's an understanding that this is donated money and the donors have a right to know how their money is being spent. Now, because in the United States, we have such a firm commitment to there being a separation between church and state, which initially was, you know, we don't want the state interfering with the matters of the church. So because of that, if you're declared a religious nonprofit, you don't have to file 990s. And I understand that initially it was probably a good impulse for that. It was that we want to be independent. We don't want the state telling us what to do. I don't think anybody envisioned mega churches with $30 to $40 million budgets with absolutely no reporting accountability. So at most mega churches, in fact, I don't even know of a mega church where the people who are giving the money know how much their pastor is making, know how much the, you know, associate pastors or executive pastors are making. But if it was a secular nonprofit, they would have to know that. And it's usually controlled. I think we have a governance issue, or often you have these mega church pastors, and they say they have an elder board that they're accountable to. But the elder board is often people who sometimes are employees, so their salary is dependent on the top guy being happy with them. Or they have ministries that, again, you know, you've got this complex, right? So you have ministries where the megachurch pastor can make or break your ministry, and they know that. And so it's often a lot of yes men that aren't really holding the pastor accountable. And we saw that. Like I know at Harvest Bible Chapel, which is was a big mega church in the Chicago area, had 5 to 7, I think, at one time campuses, and about 13,000 people coming. And even the elders, though, they had an executive elder board. And, you know, this was a very small group that would know what was going on. But the larger group of elders, which was 30 or some, I spoke to one of the elders, and he's like, they gave us a pie chart of the budget. And we had no idea what the line items were. We had no idea what James McDonald, the senior pastor, was making. But if you asked about it, then there would be retribution. So I think that's what we're seeing in a lot of these mega churches, is there's just a lack of transparency, a lack of accountability. And unfortunately, that really doesn't work well with human beings, because we have a sin nature. So that, I would say, has a lot to do with what's going on. The mega church is an issue, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed. And I think, and it's interesting too, I talked to somebody recently, and he said that he was with a group of mega church pastors, and at one point he asked him, like, Do you think maybe it's the system? Do you think there's maybe something wrong with the system? Of course, all of them have a vested interest in that system, right? And they're like, oh, no, it's just a few bad apples. You know, I'm beginning to wonder, how many bad apples do we need? Or who can handle that amount of adulation and power, and now money as well?
Julie, do you think that these big scandals are doing damage to the church in America, in the sense that are people walking away from the faith because of this?
Very much so. I would say there's a growing number of what I would call church refugees, and they're Christians. They love Jesus, but they have had such negative experiences in the church, and they're so, I would say sensitive, but really I think they're discerning. Like, they walk in and they can see how the power is being stewarded and how things are being controlled. And so they're very leery of going into a lot of churches. And we do a Restore conference, which we've done it twice, which is basically just gathering people for, you know, part of it's equipping for leaders who want, you know, are saying, we want to do it differently in our church. Like, how do we really do this differently so that we're not perpetuating the same sort of problems that everybody else is? But a lot of it is just to gather people in a safe place. And I know the last one we had in May, one of the tweets that somebody who attended said This is the first time in 6 years I've experienced corporate worship where I felt safe, because I'm with people that understand what I've been through. I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to justify myself, and I just feel safe. And somebody tweeted just this past Sunday that they're like, you know, I was in church this week, and I just keep thinking back to being in that chapel with everybody, with other survivors, and what that meant to me and how safe that felt. And so I think the church needs to realize, and it's not just here. I mean, I did a story that's happening in the UK with Fletcher and some of the abuse that went on there. And I know there's people there who have been wounded by the church, and they want a relationship with Jesus, and they need fellowship. And I know right now I'm going to a house church. Why? Because that feels safe to me. And I do think the church is going to have to think about its structures and think about how can we accommodate people and bring them in. And I see people even asking questions about the professional clergy. Like, is that really the best thing? Like, you know, maybe we need to go back to more of a lay-led model. And I don't think there's any perfect model. And I think God can work in all models. But I do think some are definitely lend themselves more to health. And I think we need to start asking those questions and looking at what might be a better system.
Do you think that for you, that would mean the ending of the megachurch model?
Yes, absolutely. And I used to qualify that up and down, and I just don't anymore. It needs to die. I think we're seeing some churches that are mega churches, multi-site, that are beginning to break up on purpose. You know, each one of those campuses are becoming their own campus. I know for our house church, for example, we just got to 40. And so we're like, it's time to split. And it's always painful to split, but it's like, we want to stay small. We want to stay in each other's lives. So I think the mega church has to die, but it's bigger than that. What about the entire industry? And we need to think about how much we have invested in this working, and do we have accountability and transparency across the board? So I do think it's much bigger than just the mega church. I know for me, when I first saw it was when I was working at Moody Radio. There's a Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, which is, you know, got a long history of, you know, 125 years since it was founded, and it was founded to train people and who are already working full time in ministry to do ministry. And it has 2 to 3 dozen radio stations throughout North America. And has, you know, I mean, some really beautiful parts of it, but I saw this in Technicolor when I was there. You know, I remember writing a commentary, which I would do commentaries all the time. And I had a senior executive come into my office and say, we're not going to broadcast this commentary you did. And I'm like, why? Is there something wrong with it? Was I unfair? Was I untruthful? You know, I mean, these, as a journalist, these are the questions I ask. And he said, no, because the person that I was writing about is our friend, and we don't report on our friends. And I'm like, really? I can report on Joel Osteen because he's like outside our tribe, right? But I can't report on our friends. We can't do that.
Almost as if you were being a traitor by doing that.
Well, a traitor, and this particular person happened to have a publishing contract with Moody Publishers. So, you know, he's making money for us.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about some of your investigations, Julie. So I think here in the UK, the Ravi Zacharias scandal was really big. He's a very well-known name here. Can you tell me a bit about how that story came about and where you fitted into that?
Sure. So the first that we began to know that there was some trouble was in 2017. And there was this whole supposed sexting scandal and also credentials scandal. So it became well known that he was inflating his credentials, and the primary person that was reporting on it happened to be an atheist lawyer, Steve Boffman. And because of that, nobody was listening to him in the Christian community. And this sexting scandal, and I hate to call it that because now we know it was sexual abuse by Ravi Zacharias. He groomed a very vulnerable woman to participate in something that was, you know, just completely and utterly clergy sexual abuse. I mean, it's just awful. But at the time, it was called a sexting scandal. And when it came out, Ravi, after getting Lorianne Thompson, who was the victim in this case, after getting her to sign a non-disclosure agreement, he publicly breaks the non-disclosure agreement with Christianity Today and puts out this whole statement painting her as an extortionist who had lured him into this relationship because she was trying to extort money from him. I mean, it's just a wicked narrative. So in 2017, I remember reading the article in CT and I believed Ravi, right? I mean, that's the way it was portrayed, and he was the one that we knew and credible and all that. And I didn't know about the backstory. Well, it was sometime in, I believe, 2019 or maybe, yeah, it was 2019, I think. Steve Boffman saw what I was doing and what I was reporting, and he sent me a copy of his book. So he published a book on all this. And I remember at the time I got it and I was so busy, I gave it to my husband. I said, can you just read? Because he loves to read. And I'm like, can you
just summarize it for me?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, give me the cliff notes. And he read it and he said, Julie, you need to read this book. And I realized that there were things, even just in what had been reported up until that point, I went back and I looked at the lawsuit because Ravi had filed this lawsuit against Lorianne Thompson. And when I went back and looked at it, one of the things that didn't make sense, for example, is he had a BlackBerry and he had this BlackBerry Messenger. And if you understand BlackBerry Messenger, you know that you need a code. That's the only way you can get into BlackBerry Messenger. So he said that he had blocked her, but she kept getting in. Well, you don't get in without a code. So the only way she could get in is if he gave her a code. So, I mean, there were multiple things like that, that they were just glaring that I looked at that. And then there were the suicide emails. And these were ones where Ravi basically said to Lorianne Thompson, if you go public, I'm going to kill myself. And, I read those and I'm like, okay, an innocent man doesn't write those. But this stayed, again, even though a lot of this had been published, I think the Christian public didn't want to hear it. They just didn't want to hear it, didn't want to believe it. And so they didn't. And it wasn't until I was able to hear more about Lori's story. And then I received a statement that she had written back before the NDA was signed. I received that and I got just sort of a download of a ton of information, of the emails, of the phone records showing that Ravi had initiated a bunch of these calls. I received gift receipts of gifts he had sent her. It just became very clear. But I remember when I published, it was about 2 to 4 weeks before Christianity Today published their story on the abuse of the women in the spas. And here again, Ravi Zacharias owned massage parlor or massage spas. I mean, who knew this? I mean, it was like an open secret, right? I mean, this is crazy. But I published about 2 to 4 weeks before Christianity Today published. And I was, even though I had all the receipts, I did a 3-part series with all the information. The backlash was virulent. It was really unbelievable. People didn't want to hear the truth, and we shoot the messenger. And it really wasn't until Christianity Today published, and then on the heels of that, World Magazine published and affirmed both my story that I had done with Lorianne Thompson, showing that she was actually the victim, not Ravi, and then CT's stories on the spa abuse. It really wasn't until both of those were confirmed by World Magazine that you really saw the tide starting to turn. And then, of course, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, RZIM, did their own independent investigation, which now we know there was a huge fight behind the scenes for the board to release that investigation. And there was so much external pressure and internal pressure that they finally did. But Ravi Zacharias is a perfect, RZIM is a perfect case study in, you know, again, a $30 to $40 million ministry. The board, who was the chairman of the board, Ravi Zacharias, who was the vice chairman, Margie Zacharias, his wife, who was a director, Sarah Davis, who was his daughter, who also served as the CEO of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. There's no accountability there. And then the rest of the board members were secret. In 2015, the RZIM filed with the IRS to become a religious, actually, it was an association of churches is what they got designated as. And then they didn't have to file their 990s. Their board was secret. Everything they did was secret. And that's just appalling. It really is appalling. And the fact that it's legal, and this is why I do what I do, because it's not going to change until people are educated. And we demand, as the donors, we demand accountability from the organizations we give to.
You mentioned the original article that CT ran, you know, with Ravi Zacharias sort of declaring his innocence. What do you think are the takeaways, Julie, for the Christian media and for Christians in general from this scandal?
There's a lot of talk afterwards, and I think it's important to think about this term betrayal blindness. And it is basically our predisposition to excuse the negative facts and believe almost to a ridiculous point the person that we've kind of put on a pedestal. And I think that's what happened within RZIM. I think there's a lot of people that now are going, oh my word, there were so many red flags. How did I miss all those red flags, right? But I think for the media as well, although I will say, I think Christian media, there's been a shift and it's been recent, but for a very long time, Christian media did nothing but PR for a lot of these celebrity preachers. And again, Christian media, you're reliant on those people talking to you, giving you interviews on, you know, when they publish the book, we want to interview them about the book. We want access to the conference. We want a behind the scenes. So, you try to nurture your sources, right? So it's challenging for the Christian media to truly be independent. But I think what we're seeing, actually in the United States, to me, it's really kind of wild what's recently happened, because you have World Magazine that historically has been the one Christian news outlet that would actually do investigation on itself, right? Reporting on our own tribe. It was World Magazine when I was reporting on James McDonald and Harvest Bible Chapel, when I was investigating them, I was actually sued by Harvest and James McDonald before I published anything. And it was really an attempt at what we would call prior restraint, which is unconstitutional. You can't restrain reporters from reporting information. So it came with like this temporary restraining order, which was immediately tossed by the judge because it's unconstitutional. But then he did sue me for supposedly defaming him, which again, I hadn't even published. But it was World Magazine that was willing to stick with me through that, because it was funny, because at the same time I was working with Chicago Tribune doing a story that was, you know, about Harvest as well. It was a little bit ancillary, but I was working with them. They dropped me like a hot potato, which you would think a big secular organization would be.
The resources behind them.
Mm. Oh my goodness. And the other thing is, you would think there'd be this commitment to the First Amendment, which in the United States, you know, this gives the freedom of the press, right? I mean, and as a journalistic outfit, you would think, yeah, we'll stand by our reporters. No, they cut me right away. And again, I didn't have a long history with them, but World Magazine, Marvin Olasky was, you know, the editor-in-chief at the time, and he was very principled. He said, we will never pull a reporter off of a story because of the negative, you know, even a lawsuit by the target of the investigation. And so he stuck with me, and, you know, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today had it not been for Marvin and the principled stance of World Magazine. Christianity Today, at the same time, published an op-ed by James McDonald on why it's biblical, sometimes biblical, to sue other believers. So it was like they gave him, I mean, it was shocking to me at the time that he's a plaintiff in a lawsuit against me. They're publishing, basically allowing him a platform to argue why it's okay to sue me, which there was no basis for suing me. And then after I published my story in World Magazine, finally this, you know, large expose on Harvest and James McDonald, CT published the entire press release in full that came out from Harvest. And basically the headline was something like Harvest disputes World Magazine article. So it was like the whole other side. So CT at that point, Christianity Today, was providing cover, I feel, for the celebrity preachers and the people with platforms. And now, interestingly, World has had a huge shift. We've seen the opinions section of World Magazine grow. Albert Mohler came in, and it's now the opinions editor. And this wall that under Marvin Alasky was, you know, impenetrable between advertising and editorial has now been eroded. Mm-hmm. And so we don't, you know, Marvin Alasky all but said he pretty much did say in a commentary that he wrote very recently that there's the integrity of the organization is just mm-hmm. gone because this wall is not being maintained. There's conflicts mm-hmm. of interest. There's a reason to protect. And so World Magazine, I think, and you've seen some of their best reporters now are going to Christianity Today. We've seen had a radical change in that, you know, Tim Dalrymple came in as CEO, Mark Galley, who had been the editor in chief, moving out, and Russell Moore now is the editor-in-chief there. But them, CT actually did an investigation on itself because of sexual harassment allegations against Mark Galley. So now you're seeing CT do more of these investigations, and which is astonishing to me to see that shift. But I do think, as a journalist, I'm glad to see CT moving into that space. I'm sad to see what World has done.
Julie, in terms of investigating the wrongdoings of pastors and churches, I would just wonder whether you become a little bit cynical about the church yourself. You know, how has this impacted your own faith? How has your work impacted your own faith?
I'm not cynical, and I hope I never become it. I love the church. And I even texted somebody yesterday. I was listening to this one song. It's such a beautiful song. It's called Gyra. And I tried to ignore the fact that it, you know, it's done by Elevation Music and Maverick City, which, you know, it's kind of ruined most CCM for me because I know too much about the business and the industry and the churches associated with a lot of these big labels. But this song it was just so beautiful. It so ministered to me. And I texted a friend and I'm like, I'm fighting to preserve the beauty that I know is in the church and the memories that I have of that and the experiences that I've had. And I mean, my life has been marked. I remember at one point when I was in my 20s, somebody said to me, your life revolves around the church and where you feel God called you to, you know, and we weren't in, you know, formal ministry at that point, but we would just go to where God, you know, to go to support the church and be a part of the ministry. And I love the church. A lot of people say, well, what motivates you to do this? It's because I love the church. It's because I care about the reputation of God. And I remember when I was thinking about reporting a big story and, you know, you'll hear all the time, you know, why would you air the dirty laundry? And I was studying the whole Babylonian exile. And it occurred to me that God didn't seem to care much about our reputation. He cares about his reputation. He cares that the people who are called by his name are living according to his principles and to see him magnified and to see his church become what it should be. And if I ever lose that, then I'll stop because I shouldn't be doing it. This is the reason to do this work, and this is what I feel I've been called to and why.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.